Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, what is the real cost of free social media apps? Well, it's actually more than you might think. Warren Buffett delivered more than 5 million% return to investors. We look at the staggering achievement in the week that he retires. Plus, have you heard of the new 358 work method? This is where the European Central Bank wants staff to leave their roles after 8 years. So does it make sense? And that is what we are going to find out. Now, I really want to thank you so much for all the messages after the last couple of weeks. It was super to hear from Sandra last weekend when she said that the piece about the Magnificent Seven earnings calls got a conversation started with her teenagers about investing at the breakfast table. And Rachel, who sent a message from Switzerland to say that the piece about Canada brought her up to speed on the country she lived in for 20 years. Geraldine, who told me that we went on the drive with her all the way from Dublin to Mayo last Sunday morning. And I also want to thank Declan and Finian for sending me their thoughts on the show every week since I took up the seat. So we love to hear from you. Please do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on LinkedIn, X or Instagram at Susan Hayes Cullerton. So I want to start off this week by explaining to you what GDP is, because economists use this term all the time, and I'm going to be asking lots of our guest questions about it. And it's also the way economists compare economies too. So here we go. GDP is gross domestic product, and it's basically the way you measure an economy. It's made up of all consumption, investment, government expenditure and net exports. So here's how to imagine the GDP of your own household. Think of all the money that you spend, save, and that goes out on tax. That basically is the GDP of your household. So imagine expanding that out then for a country. And the other thing is that when we talk about economic growth, we usually mean the growth of an economy's GDP or the growth of a country's GDP. So people talk about it a lot. And as I say, it's the way in which we measure things. And also some economists prefer other things like GNP or GNI, etc. But GDP is the most common. Now, in an age where social media and digital platforms have become deeply embedded in our daily lives, it's worthwhile really understanding how these platforms collect, use and profit from our personal data. So while users enjoy free access to services like Facebook and Instagram, TikTok and Google, the real currency is often the information that we might unknowingly hand over. Joining me now to discuss this is Chris Stokel-Walker, journalist specialising in tech, AI and digital culture. Chris, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
So we'll just start off on the point of engagement. I'm an avid LinkedIn user, among other social media. I feel it's a fantastic way to keep up with what's going on in the business world. Half of the Irish population is on Instagram. And based on the conversations that I've had with thousands of teenagers and the work that I do, many spend over 3 hours a day on TikTok. So, Chris, like, where does these platforms come up with such high levels of engagement?
They basically manage to kind of pinpoint our interests by succeeding with getting a whole load of different information about us and then presenting back to us what it thinks we want. So in your case, your LinkedIn profile will be perfectly tailored, not just in terms of the people that you follow, but the kind of content that you engage with. And we start to see that, I think, most obviously with TikTok, where all of the videos that we consume, every millisecond that we spend on a video, every time that we share the video someone else or click on a comment button or a like button, all of that goes into the algorithm that is used to try and dictate and discern what we like on our social platforms and then to try and keep us going constantly. But the real crucible here, I think, Susan, is this idea that it is always data driven.
Well, I found a piece of data that I'd like to share with you here, and that is approximately 4 million social media user identities were recorded in Ireland as of January 2024, and that represents about 79% of the total population. So let's just take 4 out of 5. Many people use social media daily without thinking twice, and really I'm one of them. But how aware do you think the average user is about the extent of the data being collected from them? Asking for a friend here, Chris.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, asking for many of our friends, asking for probably our parents, our grandparents, our relatives who come and say, well, what does Facebook know about me? What does Instagram know about me? I think the reality is that if you ask the average person, they probably don't think about this all that much. They just like the fact that the technology in front of them works and works pretty well. But we do go through phases of this. So if we cast our minds back 7 years or so, we had the big Cambridge Analytica scandal that racked Facebook at the time, that idea that actually US voters were being pinpointed precisely based on their political interests in order to try and sway their votes in the 2016 US presidential election. And that was, I think, a real wake-up call. That was perhaps the moment that we all realized, well, actually, these platforms, A, collect a lot of data about us, and B, we don't necessarily always think about that. And then C, they use that in a way that we might not always be comfortable with. So rather than just being shown, for instance, content that we really like, perhaps actually that can bleed into the real world as well. And I think that is where it's concerning. Now, over the last 7 years or so, I think our interest in that and our intention towards that has dropped somewhat, but every so often it does start to rekindle, usually around a scandal or a little bit of a kind of unnerving feeling when a platform knows a little bit too much about us.
Well, when you mentioned there earlier on how, let's say, LinkedIn knows what I like, what I click on, what I'm commenting on, etc. Like, I don't really have a problem with LinkedIn knowing that, because I'm quite happy to see content tailored to those likes, etc., on my feed. But what sort of data might social media companies be collecting about people that might surprise us?
Yeah, well, a lot of it is just very granular, and it's not necessarily the individual data points themselves, Susan, but it's what they do with that. So if we were to take, for instance, an average user, maybe they are in their late 20s, early 30s, perhaps they're thinking about starting a family. So there will be data points, perhaps they are starting to follow on Instagram some, motherhood influencers, learning a little bit about what is in store for them. That kind of gets collected and used to try and build up a picture of them. Simultaneously, perhaps they are looking on search engines for certain things that might indicate they are preparing to start a family. That too can be building up a picture that can go across these platforms in a kind of, you know, secondhand trade in data. And I think it's less about the individual bits of data that are collected, but more about the inferences that are made with that data, so that suddenly you might find that you start to get some unnerving adverts about maybe pregnancies or about perhaps, you know, your rights in terms of parental leave being shown to you when you see a Google search or when you're on LinkedIn, when you're on Twitter, when you're on TikTok or any of these platforms. And that's the moment that it really happens. So it's not in isolation these bits of data being collected, it's what happens to them afterwards. And of course, that's really where the tech companies make their money, because actually they're able then to serve adverts and to say to potential advertisers, well, if you pay us enough money, you can target people that we have a pretty good suspicion are interested in subject X or topic Y or product Z.
Something you mentioned a little bit earlier on in our conversation is, you said how the data that you're describing right now can bleed into the real world. Do you think there's a disconnect between the real world and the digital world?
Yeah, I think there still is. I think we are growing to recognise that there is no divide between these two, but certainly the conversations that I have with people who aren't breathing this day in, day out, and it's important to recognise I'm a tech journalist, I am by definition particularly interested in this stuff. They do see a kind of digital versus non-digital divide. They think they put down the phone and actually that is where that tracking, that kind of inference stops. But in reality, we see this increasingly nowadays, all of our lives are being transacted online. We're seeing digital government being rolled out, where we are now using our smartphones, using our computers, using all sorts of different stuff to try and register and interact with businesses, with governments, and with one another. So I don't think that we do have that split anymore between an online world and an offline world. But I think that there are some people who are perhaps still living 5 or 10 years in the past who think we maybe do.
Well, if we do go back to the past for a moment here, notwithstanding the FTC versus Meta case, I do just want to bring up WhatsApp for a moment, because WhatsApp was the de facto place that people went to communicate back when Meta bought the company, particularly in comparison to Facebook Messenger. And it was before Snapchat, and it certainly, if we can cast our minds back to this point, it was a lot cheaper than the cost of texts at the time. But how does Meta make money out of our WhatsApps? Because they say WhatsApp uses end-to-end encryption, which means messages are scrambled before they leave your device and are only unscrambled on the recipient's device. So what good is WhatsApp to Meta?
Well, it kind of is one of the services that they provide that allows you to have brand loyalty to this sort of stuff. So there are elements that allow Meta, the parent company of Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and others to make money. The majority of it isn't necessarily through that kind of data brokerage. It's actually often through its business services, which require you to use a little bit more information to pay a little bit more money, or through things like clicking through to WhatsApp adverts on platforms like Facebook and Instagram. So if you've ever encountered, for instance, an advert on Instagram that says, you know, click here to talk to a salesperson about buying a service or a product, and you've had your WhatsApp launched there, that's where they start to get you through the sale of that sort of stuff. There is a relative wall between WhatsApp and other Meta platforms, simply because it is that personal communication. There's no real suggestion that WhatsApp is kind of eavesdropping on the conversations that you have with your mother or your father, and then using that to try and serve you adverts, although an awful lot of people do believe that is the case. And I think that's in part because of the suspicion that we have around big tech generally, and the worries about maybe they're misusing our data.
Well, my mother still doesn't believe in having a mobile phone, Chris, because she says then people would know where she is. So WhatsApp is nothing to worry about in that case. Can I just turn the conversation to AI now in a similar vein? According to Semrush, the figures in March 2025 is that ChatGPT is now visited approximately 5.2 billion times each month, and each user spends an average of 8 minutes and 13 seconds on the site. So is it also the case that while we might be spending time on AI apps like ChatGPT or DeepSeek, we are feeding the model, and that is the currency in this particular case?
Yeah, and this is the thing that we haven't really accounted for. A billion of us now use ChatGPT. Sam Altman mentioned that at a TED discussion just last week, and it was really an eye-opener. It doesn't mean that a billion of us use it frequently, but it does mean that a billion of us have dabbled with it in some way. And I think what's interesting about ChatGPT and the other generative AI tools that we're seeing becoming really popular nowadays is that they kind of blur the boundary between private conversation and public-facing discussions. The way they are designed is to kind of be a very close confidant. They are deliberately designed to be human-like and to try and elicit information from us, and then to empathize with perhaps our worries. And a lot of us do share our worries with these generative AI tools. And that's a real concern, because we don't realize that actually we are handing over data that can be used to try and infer information about us to these big tech companies. And the way that generative AI works is it works best by knowing an awful lot about you. So it's designed to try and store that information and to reflect it back towards you. So that is, I think, a huge worry. But I think just the whiz-bang nature of this sort of product means that we don't always think about that. We don't see the kind of the cogs turning underneath the magic interaction machine, and don't think about some of the issues of that and the worries that we could have if this was to be misused.
So what advice do you have for people then when it comes to current privacy settings or data controls, or even just the fundamental way that they interact with social media or AI apps?
Yeah, so you should utilize those privacy measures to the hilt that is possible, but you should be aware that those aren't the full extent of what you can do. And a large part of this isn't relying on the tools that the tech platforms provide us with, because bear in mind, they're only going to provide us with a certain level of security that prevents us from having these concerns. Instead, we need to also think about user behavior. We need to proactively opt out of this. So think twice, type once before you put anything into these tools. And that goes, by the way, for things like Google searches. You know, be wary of what you type into that search bar, because actually it builds up a pattern of information about you. Now, you can use things like incognito windows. Those are available in many web browsers. Sometimes they're called private tabs or private windows, private browsing. That can help kind of throw off the scent a little bit. But I think just being conscious that there is this kind of parallel data economy built around understanding who you are and trying to profit from it can help change your sensibilities and the way that you act around these tools as well.
I'm just going to shift the conversation to a younger demographic for a moment, Chris. And that is that 84% of the 15 to 18 year olds in Ireland today have a Snapchat account, and 85% of those teenagers use it daily. And so in the case of Snapchat, of course, the one of the key things about that is that whatever is sent out, it disappears then right away, unless, well, within 10 seconds, unless it is screenshotted. Is it that simple?
The images, to a certain extent, although, I mean, if you are a law enforcement agency, then you can certainly ask Snapchat to try and come up with those images. And if there is a legitimate reason for it, perhaps a criminal investigation or something, then it will be uncovered. And that is, I think, just good practice around this sort of stuff, because you never know what people are sharing on Snapchat. Sometimes it's not innocuous. But in terms of, I suppose, the data collection, there is also this awareness that, yeah, you have to be conscious that actually your interactions with individuals on Snapchat, while not maybe the complete content of what you are sharing, but the kind of social network that you build up, the spider's web of interactions that you have on that platform, they are going to be used as well. So it is important that we have these discussions, I think, with our children who are more likely to use these tools, and to make them a little bit more literate about the data that is collected around them.
Just the very last question that I just want to put to you is, when we look at trends in general around social media, there's, say, growing use of Snapchat, growing use of TikTok. We're also seeing people moving on to Blue Sky. At the moment, Blue Sky's user base is growing by approximately one user per second. Beyond these trends, what are you seeing? What sort of trends are gaining momentum under the radar, Chris, that we're not seeing yet, but we'll be talking about soon?
I think one of them is kind of tied to the big trend that we're seeing overarching everything in technology at the minute, which is, you know, the rise of generative AI. But one thing that we haven't considered is actually, how do we get the products that are recommended to us into those AI tools? So AI search engine optimization of the type that we've seen for many years in the past, I think, is a big one. Mm-hmm. Likewise, I think, you know, there is an increasing awareness that actually we don't like some of the controls by these big tech platforms. And so we are kind of scattering to places like Blue Sky, as you mentioned, which is seen as a kind of a more charitable, a kinder, maybe better run place than some of these tech oligarch run platforms. I think that is another trend. And I think one of the things that is important, though, is that we can cast our minds towards the future a lot. But the reality is, we didn't see the ChatGPT moment coming 2.5 years ago. We didn't really see the implosion of Twitter, now X, either. And so it is incredibly difficult in this world to actually be able to predict the future, because it moves just quite so fast and changes quite so significantly.
Well, thank you for certainly putting the present under the spotlight there. Really appreciate that. And we leave it there. Thank you very much, Chris Stokel-Walker, journalist specialising in tech, AI and digital culture. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask, is Warren Buffett the greatest investor of all time? Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Warren Buffett last weekend, at the ripe age of 94, announced that he is to retire as CEO of Berkshire Hathaway at the end of the year. Now, Buffett is one of the richest men in the world. He grew the former textile manufacturer into a holding conglomerate with assets worth a staggering $1.154 trillion. But how did he achieve this, and who has he selected to take his place? So joining me now is Rory Gillen of Gillen Markets to discuss this with me. So Rory, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, so first off, Rory, every year Warren Buffett holds the Berkshire Hathaway meeting in Omaha in the stadium. And it started off 60 years ago with 12 people in 1965, and 40,000 people saw him make this announcement last weekend. Have you ever been at it? And if so, what's it like on the ground?
Yeah, I've actually gone for the last several years, probably the last decade, actually. It's an entertaining day, and there's always something to learn, no matter what you already know. So I find it a very entertaining event. And there's a lot of other events that go on around that day, Susan, before on the Friday and also on the Sunday. So there's plenty of other companies to meet, and there's plenty of other funds and gatherings to attend if you want, you know.
I must put it on the list myself now for next year, Rory. Actually, you're selling it to me very well. Now, while naturally the whole story last weekend was all about the retirement, can I ask you about the numbers from the actual earnings, please? Because operating earnings were down 14%. And to people who may not be familiar with that term, that basically means the profit from the operating business was down 14%. The insurance underwriting division was down 49% year on year. The total sales were down for the quarter year on year, and the costs were up, and the stock has increased 20-odd% this year. So is the stock itself looking expensive now?
Well, you've got to be very careful with what you call gap accounting, you know, the generally accepted accounting principles. And they do include funny things on the profit and loss account that probably don't have a place there. And so when you strip them out, like, for example, Susan, if he has a listed equity portfolio that, you know, that where the prices of shares of Apple and American Express, these are volatile. And that volatility obviously will change the value during the year or during a quarter. And that is reported through the P&L when in fact there hasn't been any realization of a gain or a loss. So that can be very confusing in amongst the figures. The basic insurance operations did superbly last year. The industrial companies just probably treaded water. And then he had a huge uplift on the investment side because of the his massive cash pile. And of course, interest rates have been going up, you know. So actually, if you look at what you'd call the underlying numbers, they were very sound indeed, you know.
But yet, Rory, if we look at the uplift of the equities, as you say, he is still selling stocks, including Apple, the one there that you mentioned, for the past consecutive 10 quarters. Is that because he sees that these stocks are getting overvalued now and it's time to go? Or is there another reason behind that?
Yes, I mean, he's often made pretty strategic moves. Not that often, Susan, but over the lifetime of Berkshire, you know, you might have counted maybe 8 to 10 really strategic moves. And this is probably one of them. And I think the answer is probably yes, Susan, that he does feel the US equity market is richly valued. He's been finding it difficult to find, reasonable value. Private equity operators, have been very aggressive in the last few years. So he's found it difficult to buy, large private companies in whole. You know, as you know, just for your listeners there, he buys whole companies as well as parts of companies through the stock market. He also buys whole companies. So he's found it difficult, and he's made that pretty public. And we ourselves in Gill Markets would have been saying for quite a while that we feel the U.S. stock market is very richly valued. And let me give you an example. You know, the stock market generally follows corporate earnings. So if corporate earnings grow, the stock market grows over time, and you get your dividend as well. The long-term growth rate of corporate earnings in the U.S. since 1950 is about 5.5 to 6%. And over time, the market has delivered a 9 to 10% return on that basis. So that the growth in corporate earnings plus the dividend, but it was generally valued at about 18 times those earnings. At the moment, it's valued at about 27 or 28 times earnings. So it is a good deal more expensive relative to history. And I'd say he's seeing that too. So he has been building up cash, and to be honest, I'm not surprised, you know.
Well, I'd like to pick up on that again a little bit later on in our conversation, but you mentioned going back to 1950, and I'd like to go back there too, because Buffett studied under Benjamin Graham at the Columbia University in the early 1950s. And since then, there's been enormous change, including the rise of exchange-traded funds, we could say the collapse of stockbroking fees, there's access to real-time information and others. What was accepted wisdom back then that Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett in the early days would have had that we need to let go of now?
Well, he was, Ben Graham, you know, was a product of his time, a genius in his own right, but a product of his time, which was very depressed stock market values. And Ben Graham used to teach a method of selecting companies where they would be trading below the balance sheet value and well below them with acceptable liabilities or acceptable levels of debt. And he had a very successful track record of just buying cheap companies. But in the period that Ben Graham was there and when he was teaching, it was a very depressed period because you'd come out of the Great Depression that started in 1929 and led to a pretty significant crash in the market. And then, of course, through the 30s, you know, with the US was still in depression. And then, you had the Second World War. So you had no certainty of earnings at all. And although you had progress, you had no certainty. So everything looked risky, much riskier than it proved to be in time. And therefore, values were very cheap around that time, the late 1940s. But that method of picking stocks, when the markets became more rationally valued, more, you know, investors were sort of prepared to look forward more and pay higher prices, then those bargains disappeared. And Buffett himself learnt, and he learnt off Charlie Munger too. Charlie Munger was always telling him to, stop looking for cheap stocks because you couldn't scale the business that he was trying to scale that way, and that he should find great companies and hold them forever. And eventually that's what he switched to doing. So Charlie Munger had an immense influence over him, as did Ben Graham, you know.
So to move from Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett, of course, we're now looking at Greg Abel. He is 62 years. He's from Canada. He worked in PwC, currently serves as the chairman and CEO of Berkshire Hathaway Energy. He's the vice chair of non-insurance operations. He's been with the company for 25 years. And can I ask though, Rory, as you look at this company now, from the lens that you look at from a fundamental investing perspective, does this change at the top actually make any difference to the investment proposition?
Well, I think it does, Susan. And really, the investment proposition has probably changed over the last decade anyway. I mean, the company is so big that it's, you could consider it like a tanker out in the ocean. It's extremely hard to speed it up. And really, it's, you know, the law of large numbers has caught up with Berkshire. But that, you know, so there, what I guess what I'm saying there, Susan, is Buffett or Berkshire used to grow at about 20% per annum for years. It's not growing like that anymore. It's more growing at the market rate. And of course, Buffett had, provided the X factor that he could make a big strategic move at times that made a difference. But these days, I would say Berkshire's so big that it's almost, and it's so diversified that it's almost buying a fund, with the only difference being that it's a fund that has naturally inbuilt growth because it's got cash flow every year. It's got an insurance company that throws off an insurance float, which is the same thing as leverage, except that the leverage costs the company nothing. So they get the benefit of leverage without cost. And so what I'm saying there, although it's like a fund structure, it has some characteristics that are very, very attractive. And therefore, what I tend to put it forward as either in the newsletter or to investment clients is that it's likely to do as well as US equities, but it'll do it with a lot less risk. And you can see at the moment that he's a good deal less risk because there's no borrowings in the company, apart from on the utility side where you under regulation, you have to have some borrowings. So he's got really no borrowings, and therefore he's now been selling equities, and he's got a cash pile between the insurance float and him selling equities. He's got a cash pile of something like 340 billion, which is bigger than the GDP of Ireland, you know. I mean, they're immense figures, you know.
Well, there is another benefit, though, I think that Warren Buffett has had. And I'm just going to quote you something from The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. It's a book that many of our listeners will be familiar with. And he tells a story about Buffett where he says the vast majority of his wealth accumulated after his 65th birthday. And for anybody who isn't familiar, Warren Buffett started investing when he was 11. But he said, while his annual returns are excellent, they're not unmatched. Other investors have posted similar or better returns in short bursts. But Buffett's real advantage is time. It's the power of compounding of his, in many ways, Rory, he started early enough, he persisted long enough, and he's lived long enough to have this greatness, as well as then the equity returns that have been engaging with that power of compounding. But Greg Abel is not going to have such luxury before people start casting their views, or is Berkshire Hathaway different?
No, I think that's a fair comment, Susan. And I think Greg Abel is going to have to. But he's going to have to prove himself, right? Is he a good allocator of capital? Because at the end of the day, Berkshire is an immense beast of a company at the moment. And Berkshire will continue owning the companies and the listed equities and insurance companies that it has. So really, Greg Abel's job and the others with him, which I'll comment on in a minute, is to allocate the cash that is generated each year and to make the best use you can of that. Buffett, that's really where Buffett's genius was, because as you said in your opening there, he started off, he bought into a dying textile company but he used every ounce of cash flow to diversify before the textile company actually did die, which was about 20 years later. Such was his, you know, such was his ability to be either buy list good listed equities, or else hold companies, or else buy insurance companies, or else, you know, whatever. He was just using the cash to maximum potential. Greg is the overall CEO, but Greg is Greg has you know, one of the greatest or the best insurance operators looking after the insurance side. Which is Asian Jeet. But also on the investment side, Susan, he has two world-class fund managers there that Buffett brought into the fold maybe 10 or 15 years ago. So between the four of them, you know, you have a pretty good team there, with Greg just having the ultimate say, I guess, in terms of the overall allocation of cash, you know. So I think myself, it is a changing of the guard. It's very significant. Would you sell the shares on that basis? I don't think so. I think it's going to be probably a safer investment than, say, the S&P 500. And the S&P 500 doesn't provide you with the same level of risk-free leverage. So there's a couple of attributes there that are good, you know.
So if I could put you into a seat, Rory, if you had the cash pile, that is $347 billion, $333 billion of actual cash, and the rest of it is lent to the US government, what principles would you apply? What is the Gillen Markets way?
I mean, Sir John Templeton, who was also a great investor, had a great phrase he used to use, which is, don't buy overvalued assets for your clients, and or expensive assets for your clients. So I suppose Buffett, and, you know, with that that amount of cash, is waiting for better opportunities, and he doesn't believe he sees it at the moment. And I would concur with that in the US market. But we've had a very unusual stock market cycle here, Susan, since the great the global financial crisis, in that it's the US stock market that's done the best, and it's outshone every other market. And a lot of markets have languished where there actually is good value, which suggests to us that the medium-term returns will be fine in the likes of Japanese equities, Asian equities, European equities. And so, on the one hand, you know, the US stock market is so big now that it's about 67 or 68% of the world index, as in global equities. So, you know, if you own the global ETF, you are quite dependent on US equities. Whereas if you don't like that, if you accept that they look pretty expensive, as in US equities, you know, the value lies elsewhere. That's not to say there's not great companies in the US. Of course there is. But in aggregate, it's an expensive market. Whereas I wouldn't say that elsewhere. So our own view is that if the US market is in a bear market, and my own view is that it is, it's a bear market that started. A bear market is one that, you know, is likely to be in a consistent decline for a period of time. What period of time is that? I don't know, but you know, that's as good a guess as I can get. And simply because I think it is overvalued and needs a correction. You know, how that occurs, I'm not sure. It wouldn't stop me investing cash in other areas. Japanese small companies, for example, are bargains. And, you know, Japan has changed significantly in the last 10 years in terms of its corporate governance and regulatory regime. And it's foreign investors have copped on to that, and it's benefited. But Japanese smaller companies have been left behind and look like a very good place to invest for the medium term, you know.
Well, you know, there's so much more I could ask you about, whether it's, are we at the end of US exceptionalism? What about the European relative outperformance, this change in the structure of Japan, etc.? And we leave all that for another day. But Rory, I have to ask you this before we finish up, and that is, what is your favorite Buffett quote?
I think it probably is, you know, I think it is. I think he said it back in 1999 when people were giving out to him for not having invested in technology. And he was being interviewed at the time. And he said at the time that we'll see who's swimming naked when the tide goes out. And I just thought it was a beautiful quote, because you don't have to be an investor to understand what he's saying there. And he basically felt that everything's overhyped, and he'll still be standing when everyone else seemed to have no clothes on, you know.
A colourful quote there, Rory, to finish up our conversation today. Thank you very much indeed, Rory Gillen from Gillen Markets.
Thank you, Susan.
And this is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, we will hear why the European Central Bank wants staff to move every 8 years. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. So how would you feel about moving jobs every 8 years? And I don't mean moving companies, I mean moving internally. Well, that is something the ECB, or the European Central Bank, is bringing in this year. And I'm delighted to be joined by Polita Clark from the Financial Times, who has been writing about the move, and also by Caroline Reedy of the HR Suite. You're both very welcome to the show today.
Thanks, Susan.
Okay, Polita, we'll start off with you there, please. What is the 3-5-8 plan the bank wants to implement, and why do they want to do it?
So this plan is called 3-5-8 because they want their staff to spend the first 3 years in a new role, basically building up their knowledge and their expertise in that particular job. And then they want them to use the time up to about year five to start planning a move from that role. And they want that move to ideally happen by year eight. And if it doesn't happen by then they are basically saying they're going to be, staff should expect to have a chat with their managers about where they might go next. And the reason they're doing it is not because they want to force people to move jobs. They say it's not going to be mandatory. And they also say that people don't have to move outside their professional domains. But they want to make sure that people get a broader experience and broader knowledge, particularly when it comes to fast-moving digital technologies, AI, other areas where developments are happening very quickly. And they worry that if people stay in the same roles, they may not be as competitive and as on the ball and have the same sort of edge required at an institution like the ECB.
And as you know, Polita, strategy beats culture for breakfast. So what I would like to just ask you about is the culture, because there was a report out in March that says in the UK, the 10% of roles are filled by existing staff, which is the highest rate among the countries studied within that particular report. But that was down from 40% during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic. So what does this tell us about the culture of moving into new roles in the UK internally?
That's interesting because it's, you know, two very different times, I guess, the pandemic versus non-pandemic times. But in general, I guess, you know, 10% is a fairly low figure, I would say. But I find it really interesting because I think there's basically the tendency to want to move into new roles varies inordinately depending on where you are in your career. I think younger people are really keen to do it, and by and large older people, by which I mean sort of people in their late 40s and 50s, tend to not necessarily want to do it quite so much. And I think that's because, you know, when it comes to building your career, you want as much experience, you want to get as much opportunity for promotion when you are younger. Obviously, when you're older, sometimes you've been through that and you're keen to kind of settle in and, you know, I guess for some people, it's a case of holding on to what they've got for as long as they can. So I think it does really depend very much on where you are in your career.
Caroline, can we talk about job switching in general? Because I found a report from the Central Bank here in Ireland from last December, and that said that workers earned an average of 7.5% more in the quarter directly following a job-to-job flow between 2019 and 2023 compared to a 1.6% increase for stayers. The difference in the wage growth between the two groups has declined to 2.1% in 2023. So people ultimately earn more from actually leaving an organisation and moving to another one rather than negotiating a salary, even if it comes from a different job in an existing organisation. So what's the feeling about job mobility on the ground at the moment here in Ireland?
I think a lot of organisations, Susan, have moved completely now to the concept of change is so constant. We need to have more of an agile view of skills rather than a set definition of what we were used to traditionally in job descriptions and set job roles. So, for example, we're seeing organisations who may say, look, I have too many people in finance, I need to move them to other areas of the business that need them more, that might be in need, and it's so hard to get skills that a lot of people are moving into cybersecurity roles. And even though they might have a different kind of set of skills on the top level, it's very transferable skills between roles. And we're seeing now that organizations are a lot more focused on agile skills being transferred within roles than defining people by the job that they do. And I think in this European Central Bank example of the 3-5-8 concept, not a lot of our people now are planning to stay in an organization for 8 years. So unless, I would suggest that that is speeded up a lot within the organization, people won't necessarily stay around, you know, for that long, because people want to be moving. They want change. They want, you know, especially the newer, you know, four generations in the workplace, but the new generation of employee is all about, you know, the economy, you know, needs to of work needs to suit them and their work-life balance much more than the traditional role of I'm here to stay for 8 years. So I think we're going to see a lot more shifts to that. And this is a little, you know, nod to that.
Pilita, that whole idea of people wanting to change, wanting to move, not planning to stay there for up to 8 years, as Caroline has said there, you mentioned in your piece about the European Central Bank that staff can work for as long as 3 years at other global financial institutions, knowing they have a return ticket to the ECB. What do you think of encouraging such boomerang employees?
I mean, I think it's great, but I think it gives people the opportunity to go and learn about all sorts of new things in new organisations, and people would often like to do that, but they are often a bit nervous about doing, particularly if it means moving countries, taking their families with them, and the idea that you've got a permanent berth back at the mothership is, of course, incredibly comforting. And I mean, just on that point that Caroline was making earlier about people not necessarily in general wanting to stay in a job for 8 years, I think that's absolutely right. But at a place like the ECB, they're such a relatively generous employer, really, that a lot of people do want to stay there for a long time. They have most people on permanent contracts. Most people apparently work there until retirement age, which is 65. They have an incredibly low turnover rate of about 1.8%, which is very low by most standards. So, you know, they're the sort of organization that really does have a problem with or a potential problem with people staying in roles for a little bit longer than might work for them, broadly speaking. But, you know, that's definitely not the case in all organizations. And I think this is definitely a sort of a policy that works very well for some organizations and would be completely wrong for others.
Caroline, if we could switch to the perspective of the employee here for a moment, because the whole purpose of this idea at the ECB is to raise workforce skills as AI and data technologies upend the shape of jobs in a raft of sectors. And you mentioned there, for example, job descriptions around cybersecurity and so on. My own staff and myself are certainly feeling the positive effects of the excitement of that. But for people today who think, God, I better upskill myself in these areas to make sure I'm still relevant, what do you suggest they do?
I think that most organisations now have a lot of options of how people can upskill and really, I suppose, take advantage of the vast amount of types of learning opportunities that are there, whether that's, you know, opportunities to work on different projects, work in interdepartmental team, cross-mentoring, doing kind of micro-learning, which is much more what's on trend at the moment, which is short learning bites. There's obviously a raft of information available as well now via TED Talks and, you know, opportunities, I suppose, that never has been there. So the opportunity is endless. I think the key thing for people to make sure is that they're doing a gap analysis of what are the things that could put a ceiling on my career development? How am I going to make sure that I'm making myself fit for the future? And agile skills like resilience, things like influencing, things like communication skills, getting really good at those and many others like them will make sure that you're really relevant to the future of work and the future of skills and be ready and able to take on new opportunities as they come on your terms a lot of the time, which means that you can ask for the opportunity to work abroad or you have the opportunity to work remotely or you have the opportunity to travel or get that next promotion where you are. So I think it's a very exciting prospect for those that embrace it because opportunities are going to be, you know, there for those that are ready for them.
And as you say, the educational opportunities of meeting them are very much available and accessible now, whether it's inside the company or outside. Pilita, you noted in that piece that staff only use a bit more than half of the remote days they were eligible to take in the European Central Bank. But you also said, like, the ECB offers 110 such working days. So what's the feeling on the ground in London at the moment about working from home or indeed working from anywhere?
Well, in London, it's really interesting. And in fact, globally, there's a group of economists who've been tracking work from home trends ever since the start of the pandemic. And I've been tracking their tracking. And it's really interesting to me because we see so many headlines constantly about these big companies, whether it's Wall Street banks or big advertising agencies like WPP or Uber or other well-known companies that are basically saying to management, well, it's time that the white collar people at least start spending more time in the office, and they're basically tightening up their remote working policies. And this is, of course, you know, it's definitely happening. However, when you look more closely at what businesses of all shapes and sizes are doing, the work from home rates have not really shifted that much since around 2022, 23. They've remained remarkably stable. So I think London is quite similar to other cities, particularly cities that have a lot of commuters who really, really value the ability to work remotely. You know, it's basically changed the shape of working life here in a way that feels at the moment quite permanent. Whether it will be, I don't know. But, you know, I think most people I talk to in the City of London and thereabouts who've got the ability to work remotely are doing it, and organisations are by and large still allowing it to happen. So whether that remains the same forever, I don't know. But it does seem, feels fairly permanent at this point.
And Caroline, a big concern that anybody might have listening to us today who thinks, okay, I want to maintain my people, I want to offer them opportunities, I like the idea of the 358, I like the idea of offering remote working, but the one thing I'm worried about is the loss of tacit knowledge or institutional wisdom as people move around. So as a final word today on our conversation, what processes do you suggest for employers to put in place to make sure that proper peer learning is happening all the time?
I think a lot of organisations realise how important now it is to have workflows, systems, peer learning groups, opportunities for learning transfer, reverse mentoring. There's the learning and development function and department has changed so much to need to move with the current needs of learning and development. But I think that's one of the key, I suppose, concerns, that and networking and influencing and building people's network within the organisation. But I think we can manage that because the benefits way outweigh the challenges that people have to embed in those learning and development opportunities.
Well, I want to thank you both very sincerely for being on the show today. Polita Clark from the Financial Times, as well as Caroline Reedy from the HR Suite. Thank you very much to you both.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks, Susan.
And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and a little bit of investing in there too, as well as how it affects our world. So I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go for your podcasts. And make sure to subscribe to the show. And it's also on radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Hugh Keenan. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks a million for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day. I look forward to chatting to you again next week.